This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yale law professor turned novelist Stephen Carter writes page-turners that blend suspense, murder, and some serious talk about race relations. His debut novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, topped the bestsellers list. He followed up with the blockbuster New England White. In his new whodunit, black power brokers set their sights on the White House. You can't help but hear the Obama drumbeat. This hour on Point, Black and White America, in a political thriller with Stephen Carter. Joining me now in the studio is Stephen Carter. By day, he teaches at Yale Law School. By night and weekends, he turns out best-selling novels. His latest is Palace Counsel. Stephen Carter, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
How on earth do you find time for this? You do have a big day job, don't you?
My wife likes to say that if I'm willing not to sleep, I can do most things. But I do most of my fiction writing at night and on the weekends. And during the day, I teach my students. I teach ethics. I teach about the law of war. I teach a variety of courses, and I love that job, too.
Play a little then and now game with us, if you would. Your story is set, it's between sort of Brown versus the Board of Education, mid-1950s, and end of Nixon administration, early 1970s. But it's hard is in the 60s. Play a then and now game with us about black access to power in this country, your dynamic, the dynamic that's playing around out around all of us right now.
You know, it's funny. In a lot of ways, the 60s are very similar to the present age, which is one reason I thought of setting a thriller there. Even if you leave aside race for just a second, think about it. A weak economy, an unpopular incumbent, a political party in serious trouble. People think it's going to be gone for years and decades to come. But at the same time, you're right to raise the race issue because in another odd way, we have so many unresolved issues from that era as well. The difference now, I think, is that Barack Obama, who many people think is going to be elected president in November and perhaps will, he doesn't come out of the tradition of these old and powerful and shadowy, well-connected African-American families who are some of the conspirators in my story. He comes out of a very different background. Like a lot of people who've aspired to the White House and succeeded to the White House in American life, his background is relatively modest.
Set us up to understand that conspiracy you're describing there. Give us a little sort of plot in a nutshell, and then we'll take off from there. Well, Palace Counsel.
Palace Counsel revolves around a plot that begins sometime in the 1950s by a group of powerful families, black and white, to over time, very gradually, groom candidates and ultimately win the White House for the interest of these various powerful families who then in the background be running things. One of the conspirators has a change of heart. He's murdered, and my hero, Eddie Wesley, discovers his body in the 1950s, and that launches Eddie and his girlfriend, Aurelia, on what ends up being a 20-year quest to figure out what's going on.
Eddie Wesley, the protagonist, your hero here, like you, a black writer of some renown, greater renown, really. You make him, one great big literary figure who ends up in the Kennedy administration, ends up at Richard Nixon's side. He's everywhere. He's Zelig.
You know, the idea of Eddie Wesley as a character came to me in exactly that way. A lot of people don't realize, I think, how close African-Americans, some small group of African-Americans, have been to the levers of power in America for a very long time. And there were a number of people who rose high in the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration. It was a small proportion of black America, but those people were there. And there were also people who raised a lot of money who were black fundraisers. And I talk about that in the novel as well. It's part of a history that I think we miss so much that some people, when they see a story where black people have the kind of access to levers of power, they think, this can't be real. This isn't plausible. This doesn't make any sense. But it was true.
Well, I have to say, my first reaction was along those lines. What a black and white cabal, secret cabal in the 50s and 60s, you know, aiming to put their civil rights champion in the White House and putting lives on the line, murder and death threats and all the rest here. On the other hand, that was played out certainly on the back roads of the South by white supporters of civil rights who put their lives on the line at that level to do it. But really, around the White House with, was there anything like this is this pure fiction?
I'm sure it was nothing like this. When I write conspiracy theories in my fiction, I do them because they work well in fiction. Mm-hmm. I'm not a conspiracy theorist in real life. That's just for fun. I think it makes mm-hmm. good storytelling. But at the same time, I think it appeals to something in us that we like to think, I hope we like to think, that maybe life isn't all suffering. Here I'm speaking of African-American life, for example. There are people out there who've had these various positions of power. And in the larger sense, as a country, I think we are enchanted sometimes by conspiracy theorists. We're enchanted by the notion that there's somebody behind what's going on. There's somebody to love, somebody to hate, somebody to thank, somebody to reject. It's not just random. The random mess it often seems to be.
I wondered in reading this if it won't happen, of course, because it's book length and you have to get through hundreds of pages to see the whole picture. But, you know, if this could be seen on one page, if this wouldn't in a way be upsetting to the Obama campaign in the same way that the New Yorker cover is upsetting to them, because it puts black access to power in terms of conspiracy, in terms of race, in terms of like, a, you know, a deliberate, almost rifle-toting plan to get it. The kind of, you know, equivalent of Michelle on the New Yorker cover with her AK-47
over
her
shoulder. Wasn't the New Yorker cover a terrible thing? That was so bothersome.
Well, have you made a book-length version of it?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, I think it's important to remember that I'm writing about a different era. And in the 50s and 60s, there were lots and lots of well-meaning people who were black and well-meaning people who were white who thought that America would only change at the point of a gun, who thought America would only change if there was some kind of radical, violent political energy. That's one of the reasons so that we see, for example, in the novel that my hero, Eddie Wesley, has a sister, Junie, who his beloved sister goes to mm-hmm. Harvard Law School, but ends up being drawn into radical politics and winds up actually underground, wanted by the FBI for the various things a radical group has done. There were a lot of people in the 60s who thought that was the only way to change America. Now, they were wrong in the 60s. That wasn't the way to change America then. And now, fortunately, very few people talk that way anymore. And one of the things you see in the Obama campaign and its enormous successes is that it turns out that at least in the 2000s, it is possible to work within the system for change in a way that many people thought it was not possible in the 50s and 60s.
But hasn't Barack, and this goes too far, this overstates it, but hasn't he at some level tried to make this a race-less campaign, a race-less assumption of power, if he makes it? Whereas your book puts it, of course, it's back in the 60s, but it puts it very much in race-identified terms. We shall overcome.
Well, Obama is not running for president of black America. He's running for president of America, for president mm-hmm. of the United States. And it's perfectly sensible for him to take the view that he's going to be the president of all the people if he wins. But at the time when I'm writing, back in the 1950s and 60s, I think a lot of people's perceptions were very different, and there was a strong strain in African America and in other progressive politics, as well as, by the way, in reactionary politics as well, a very strong strain that said, if we want to do something, we've got to do it ourselves. We saw a lot of violence in the 60s on the right and the left, and I try to capture a lot of that in the story. It's a part of the era. We remember the assassinations. Remember the Kennedys. Mm-hmm. Remember King. Remember some of the civil rights workers who were killed. We don't remember often, as we think about in the 60s, the violence, the bombings, and so on. And that was also part of that culture.
And so here you've got your man, Eddie Wesley, right in the middle of all this. Give us a sense of his path. I mean, he's there, writing speeches for JFK. He's trying to figure out what's going on around him. His people drop dead, and he stumbles over upside-down crucifix and all the rest.
Yeah, Eddie Wesley, when he's starting out as a writer, nobody's ever heard of him. That's when he first discovers this body in Harlem of one of the conspirators. Mm-hmm. It's a white Wall Street lawyer, very prominent lawyer. What he's doing dead in Harlem, nobody knows. And Eddie, over the years, as he seeks the conspiracy, he also grows. He publishes a couple of novels. They're well-received. His family knows the Kennedy family. They do each other favors. He ends up working on the campaign. He works in the White House in the Kennedy administration as the deputy head of speech writing. He eventually leaves the White House, and then he becomes a full-time writer again. He writes a very controversial essay about Richard Nixon, in which he says that Nixon is like America. America likes winners, and Nixon always, the guy who always finds a way to win, and as long as you don't look too closely at how he does it. And Nixon, misunderstanding the essay, thinking that it's a compliment instead of an insult,
right.
becomes his friend and starts saying what a great guy he is. And Eddie's always trying to stay away from him, and Nixon's always trying to say, this is my buddy. And so on. And so Eddie goes through the years. He becomes a writer. He goes to Vietnam. He becomes completely radicalized. He becomes a big opponent of the war and a big member of the hard left by the late 60s, early 70s. And yet at the same time is still trying to work out this conspiracy, because even though his politics are of the left, he's still uneasy about the methods that some people use.
You suggest that the Nixon view has won in this country, that whatever it takes to win has that there was a kind of battle is still underway in the 60s. The Nixon view won, I guess Stephen Carter says.
I think in a sense that's true. That is, Nixon represented a side of America that said the most important thing is winning. Just don't look too closely at who did it and how we do it. And unfortunately, I love my country dearly, but one of the weaknesses of America, I think, is we do love and celebrate winners, and we act so surprised. This athlete cheated, this politician cheated, and yet we don't ask usually how they're winning. We just want to be in the stands cheering and don't tell us any of the details. And that, I think Nixon was the epitome of that. He got caught. He was deservedly driven from office. I'm glad we got rid of him. But there is something about America even now, I think, that's Nixonian in that sense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a tale of black and white power brokers, race, and the White House with Yale Law School professor and best-selling novelist Stephen Carter, author of the new political thriller Palace Council. Stephen Carter joins me in the studio, and maybe you'd read a little bit for us. You've got Eddie Wesley, your hero, on his way to literary prominence here, and a little taste of Eddie in Chapter 1 of Palace Council, Stephen.
You know, let me read this, a little introduction to Eddie and to Aurelie, his longtime love interest, because in addition to a thriller, it's also supposed to be a love story.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the beginning of Chapter 1. Had Eddie Wesley been a less reliable man, he would never have stumbled over the body, chased Junie to Tennessee, battled the devils to a draw, and helped to topple a president. But Eddie was blessed or perhaps cursed with a dependability that led to a lack of prudence in pursuing his devotion. He loved only two women in his life, loved them both with a recklessness that often made him a difficult man to like, and thus was able, when the moment arrived, to save the country he had come to hate. A more prudent man might have failed. As for Aurelia, she arrived with her own priorities, very conventional, very American, and so from the start very different from Eddie's. Once they went their separate ways, there was no earthly reason to suppose the two of them would join forces, even after the events of that fateful Palm Sunday and what happened in Hong Kong. But join they did, by necessity more than choice, fighting on alone when almost everybody else had quit or died. Almost everybody.
Mm. Stephen Carter reading from Palace Council. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and we've got the toppling of a president on Palm Sunday in Hong Kong and an era of civil rights and a conspiracy to push for that, a kind of cabal that with all kinds of implications in the new book right here. Let's take a call right off the bat from Boston. Carl, you're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Hello. What I'm curious about is whenever everyone frames these civil rights issues, whenever it's minorities being oppressed, whether it's women, blacks, wherever, they always talk about how it should be nonviolent. Yet when white Christian men were being oppressed, we had the Revolutionary War. When the Civil War came up in states' rights, where landowning whites were being denied their rights to own slaves, everyone thinks violence is fine. Yet when it comes to fighting for anyone who's a minority, being violent is somehow always considered wrong. It wasn't wrong for the police to beat these poor women in Selma, but it was wrong for people to fight back. That's the part that just always amazes me, that if it was a white Christian man being brutalized by police and being held down, we'd say we need to have a call to arms. Yet when it's minorities, women, or gays, no one's supposed to become violent when they're being oppressed.
Carl, we've got it. Kind of a fight the power, fight for rights, and Stephen Carter. Is that the impulse that's behind the conspiracy that your fiction describes here? It's worth fighting for, and let's do it.
I agree with much of what the caller says. I think there are times when you can only attain your rights by fighting for them. So I think the slave revolts, for example, which were violent, were perfectly justified. They didn't work, but they were perfectly justified. The question about violence, for me, I think violence is always the last resort, but there are times when it is the only resort. And I think we have to acknowledge that when people are truly oppressed, there may be such times. When you have a battered woman killing her husband in order to escape, I don't know why she would get prosecuted for that. During the civil rights era, you had a divide. You had some people who thought violence was the only way, and some people who thought that active nonviolent resistance was the only way. Some people think you needed both forces historically in order to achieve something. In the end, both forces died out. My regret today is not about violence or nonviolence. It's rather that our national conversation has moved away from racial oppression and onto other things.
So when Obama kind of glides above a lot of that, is he, in his rebuke to James Wright, maybe in his rebuke to Jesse Jackson, is he kind of rebuking our caller, and saying, no.
No, I don't want to turn into a seminar on Obama, but I do think that as a presidential candidate, it's very difficult to take a position in favor of a lot of kinds of activism that you might in other contexts support, and I think we all understand that.
Mm. Let's get a call from Savannah, Georgia, and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just was thrilled when I turned the radio on and Professor Carter was on. I am on my second book, New England White. Wow. I absolutely love the way you write.
Thank you.
I enjoyed insight for the paler nation and the darker nation, the elite, the power shakers of both colors, and your take on the characters. And I can't wait to read this third book that's coming that you're talking about now. I just wanted to get that in. I'm thrilled that you're on, and I really, really do like the writing. I feel like I'm getting insight, and I appreciate that.
Elizabeth, tell us what you've learned from Stephen Carter that you didn't know before.
We're all alike. we're all alike. I mean, I know we're different colors, we're different shades, we're different nationalities, but underneath it all, I believe we're all alike, and I know that sounds possibly Pollyannish, but we all strive for, we all want, we all have the same needs, the same wants, and that's a very generalization, a very generalized way of saying that that I believe that we're all alike. In New England White, the wife, the professor's wife, I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm that woman.
Well, any writer likes to hear that, but let me just say very briefly that while I write thrillers, I try to make families and characters who are universal and recognizable, and I hear that a lot about my writing. People say, I know that person, I am that person, I've met that person, and so on, across racial and other lines. Mm. And that, of course, is what any writer strives for, so I'm very, very grateful that it struck you that way.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and I look forward to hearing the rest of your conversation and to reading your third book. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Elizabeth raises the paler nation, the darker nation. Remind us of that language. You use it. What's it about?
Those were a couple of phrases that I invented in my first novel, because my first novel, the central character, who was dead at the time, but nevertheless, central character, Oliver Garland, had been this very powerful personality, this big black judge. And it always seemed to me he would always have some different way of referring to things than other people did. So in the first novel, I referred to this as something he came up with. Instead of saying black and white or African-American, he would say the darker nation and the paler nation. In this novel, I said Eddie Wesley invented it. The phrase has kind of stuck with me. And I just find it an interesting phrase and fun to use. It's not that I'm proposing that we change the way we talk about these things, but in the fiction, I like the phrase.
Elizabeth, thank you for your call. You follow through your books this Garland family, very high place, kind of upper crust African American family. It's not by any means the sort of American stereotype of we played around with the war, you know, and the ghetto sound with the music going out of the last segment. It's something quite different indeed. Why have you based your novels in that sort of exalted top fringe end of the black American world? And does that lead white readers to say more often to you, oh, I recognize this, because you're putting out a kind of elite there?
Well, I'm not sure Palace Council is set quite as much in that world as the others. It's certainly not intended to be. But you're right that I do talk about those families. I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by the notion of power generally and the idea that historically there have been these very small numbers, admittedly, of shadowy, well-connected, powerful black families is one that I've found fascinating. And I realize most people don't know much about that. It's not the universal African-American experience. It's not the usual African-American experience. But I think it's a really important part of the African-American experience that's worth thinking more about. And power has fascinated me as a law professor and as a novelist. Indeed, if you write thrillers as I do, power is what you keep coming back to.
You've got Eddie again saying that he had been bred much against his will to a disdain of a certain kind of Negro, as you're sort of describing the thoughts going through his mind. Is that about this kind of class structure within the African-American community?
Yeah, the downside is that historically a lot of those powerful, well-connected families have looked down their noses a bit at people not like them. So I didn't come from a wealthy, well-connected family.
You personally?
I personally. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a lot of families. I was once at a dinner, I remember, where the conversation turned. This is an older family, but where people have gone to school and things like that. The sort of thing that we imagine hearing around the dinner table in old WASP families.
With the social medals on your chest.
Exactly. You can hear in some of the old black families as well. But that's also why it was so irresistible to me to have a conspiracy that involves jointly some old black families and some old white families working for very different ends. You mentioned civil rights, but the white families and the black families in this conspiracy may have different goals, but you have this conspiracy with these different families pooling their connections and their resources with a plan to try to win the presidency. The only question is which group of them is winning.
You've got so much of this set around the Oval Office, we can't help thinking about Obama. Give us a little x-ray of social structure and where Barack Obama, with his very famous, very particular racial background, and Michelle Obama, with her Chicago background, fall in the African-American social ladder that you've written about and know well?
Well, wherever people may think they fall, if they're in the White House, they'll fall in a very different place. I want to make very clear that I don't defend at all the prejudices of a lot of these older families. I simply describe them. I don't think this class structure is a good thing.
Limited to African America, so you don't.
Not at all. That's right. And in fact, what makes it interesting to me is exactly the opposite. That it duplicates, it mimics mm-hmm. in some ways the class structure you see, say, in white America. The one thing I will say about Obama, I think that Obama's triumph, whether he wins the election or not, mm-hmm. the triumphant position he's in now, I think, I hope, has already done a lot to shake up people's perceptions, black and white, of where successful black people come from and so on, because he's someone, he and his wife both, who have come from, who've overcome a lot, I think, to get to where they are.
Let's take a call from Joan in Boston. Joan, you're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, what do you know, Joan?
Well, I'm just calling to say that I've read the first two books. I really, really enjoyed them. What I really appreciated was that Stephen took the concept of what I would say is the Huxtables from Bill Cosby and made it a deeper dimension.
Now, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, because America kind of looked at the Huxtables and said, ooh, African Americans are middle class too. They go to college. They have jobs.
They wear Argyle sweaters.
Exactly. And so, and it really opens it up for white America to be comfortable to look at African Americans and kind of see what's going on, which is nice. Often I feel like African Americans and people of color are often educating Europeans as to how we live. We know how you live, but you don't know how we live. And so these books do that in some way, in that they show middle class African Americans. They also show middle class African Americans who have many dimensions and are not all on the same page and don't all believe the same things. And they belong to different clubs. And in the second book that Stephen wrote, what I really, really liked was not only did we have a black family in a predominantly white community, we had a community that wasn't all that comfortable with them. And then there was a community that the African-Americans, the upper-class African-Americans who were in the story didn't really touch base with and had no understanding of.
Yeah.
And I like that. It was, you know, it was a very well thought out book. The minute he said the darker nation and the
Taylor.
Lighter nation, I understood it completely. You didn't have to explain it to me. I knew exactly where he was. And I just have to say to you, kudos for the ladybug.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me just pick up, John, on one
part of what you said.
That there is this interesting, I try to trace this diversity. There was more political diversity, I think, in the African-American community in the period I'm writing than the period now. Today, black people vote 90%, 80 to 90% Democratic. And there's a historical reason you can understand. But back in the 50s and 60s, it was not unusual for large numbers of black people, especially those with money, to vote Republican. And in my story, my hero, Eddie Wesley, he is part of a big Democratic family. His father knows the Kennedys. He works in the Kennedy White House and so on. His girlfriend, his longtime love interest, I should say, Aurelia, she marries into a black family, but it's a very Republican and well-connected family. And those kinds of divisions were not at all unusual then. They're much more unusual now.
Let me ask you, while we're on this, and Joan's saying, you know, that this shows us things we don't know, maybe if the we is white there, but what about this the sort of genteel, privileged black elite, again, where you've set a lot of your fiction and its perspective maybe on Barack Obama's racial profile? This is also an upper crust that tends to be paler within the darker nation. Does that give them a particular perspective on Barack's mixed racial parentage?
Well, first, I want to make very clear that in writing these stories, I'm trying to write entertainments. I'm not writing anthropology. I'm not trying to give a lot of deep insight into the community. But on that question, it's been my experience that the enthusiasm for Obama in the black community is across class and other lines. It really is quite remarkable how swiftly the community is united, because there was a time a year and a half ago, I think, when there were a lot of black people who had questions about Obama.
Jesse Jackson didn't sound so enthusiastic last week.
No, and I don't know what that was all about. Some people said it was almost a changing of the guard moment. I don't really know what it was. I think that there will always be some tensions, but I'm not sure. Whatever else it was, I don't think it was a class tension, even if it was a political tension of some kind.
A color consciousness?
I think you're putting too much into it. Whatever it was, and I'm not in either man's mind. I don't know either man, so I can't say what was really behind it. It may have just been a disagreement among friends. I don't know. What I do think, though, as I say, is that as I travel, as I talk to black Americans around the country, even on this book tour, I find enormous, not just support, but enormous enthusiasm that cuts across all sorts of lines. Not everybody's enthusiastic. I meet black opponents of Obama as well. But that's not the way that it tends to run. The sentiment tends to run in favor of him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a tale of black and white power brokers, race, and the White House with Yale law professor and best-selling novelist Stephen Carter, author of the new political thriller Palace Council. There's a cabal, black and white, high-powered folks who are looking to push a civil rights agenda, maybe a bit more. It gets very complicated. It's set in the 1960s. What do you think? Does Stephen Carter's, have you read it, does this new tale light up the Obama candidacy in any way, the New Yorker cover flap in any way? And what do you make of Carter's fictional world of the upper crust black experience and maybe beyond as well? You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Pam in New Haven, Connecticut. Pam, you're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Professor Carter. Professor, I'm more familiar with your nonfiction than I am your fiction. I am in the middle of The Emperor of Ocean Park, and I'm completely enthralled. I really am enjoying it. But I read in an editorial that you wrote this weekend in the Times called
Affirmative Distraction, about a week ago.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed reading your writing, et cetera, on affirmative action for a while. But I just wanted to clarify, if I'm understanding what you wrote in that editorial, you're saying, you know, that trying to get really smart, high-achieving blacks into elite colleges is a distraction from the real issue of poverty, and that if we don't do more to get blacks, the overrepresentative proportion of which, you know, I mean, blacks, certainly there are more whites than blacks who are impoverished. I mean, more whites than blacks. But
a higher percentage of blacks. And of course, Stephen Carter says it's a distraction. Affirmative action,
yeah,
in a way, is a distraction.
Let me clarify what I was trying to say. And although I always enjoy working with the Times editors, I don't choose the headlines for the op-ed pieces. Mm. My point was not that there's anything wrong with affirmative action programs in college admissions. I was not saying that. I was saying that by arguing about that so much on both sides of the spectrum, we avoid arguing over how to help the people who are suffering most in America. Many suffer from poverty. Many suffer from the mix of poverty and racism. My argument has been for years and continues to be that neither political party really has much to say about that, especially about poverty. We talk about other issues, and depending on whether one's on the left or the right, we talk about issues with which we're more ideologically comfortable, but we don't really focus very much, as we should, I think, on those who are suffering most. So it's not that there's something wrong with affirmative action. It's that by making that what we talk about when you argue about race, we don't argue about the plight of those who are suffering most. And that is, I think, where we really ought to be continuing the argument from the 60s, the period when my novel is set, when race was at the center of the political agenda, and now it's kind of slipped to one of a dozen issues on which people are expected to have a position as opposed to the central moral issue in American life.
Maybe that's what Jesse Jackson is complaining about when he's unhappy with Barack Obama, that Barack Obama doesn't want to put race at the center as a central moral issue.
That may be what he's complaining about. I don't know. I'm not sure it's necessarily Obama's job, because as I said, he wants to be president of all of America, not just of black America. But it is an important point. That is, if you look at the 1960s, the period when my thriller is set, you find that you couldn't be in public life actively unless you had something to say about race and poverty. Those are the central concerns. And what was interesting is, as the war went on and on, the Vietnam War, here we're talking about, wars do tend to drag, but here we mean the Vietnam War, and more progressive energy turned to the war, race began to slip aside. It wasn't so much a central concern. And by the end of my novel, in the mid-70s, race had already been supplanted by other issues. When I say supplanted, I really mean that the racial issue in America had not been solved. We hadn't achieved racial justice, but we just decided to move on to other things.
You've got Richard Nixon presented in some ways, despite, you know, what you say about the values sort of shift that he was part of maybe in American culture, there's an element of sympathetic portrayal here. You remind us in fiction that he was thinking about civil rights long before some others were, prepared maybe to act on them. And then you've got him out walking through protests in Washington, having breakfast outside the White House.
Well, he really did that. What's interesting is Nixon is a complicated guy. He had his demons, and he was not a good president. And his main problem was the willingness to do anything. He had I'm not sure he had real beliefs. He had the belief in winning. And so in the 1950s, he was actually in civil rights, a liberal Republican. He pushed Eisenhower to try to get a Voting Rights Act and so on. And so I put that in the book. And in 1970, after the murders at Kent State, where the National Guardsmen killed the students, there was a huge May Day demonstration. At that time, the biggest demonstration, anti-war demonstration ever held in the United States, in Washington, D.C. And it really is true. The night before that demonstration, Nixon wandered out of the White House, went over to the mall where the students were sleeping, And 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, was talking to them, trying to justify his position. I think he had this deep need to be loved. It's something he'd missed somehow. I wanted people to like him and understand him. And so I used that in the fiction. I added some details to it, but I used that night in the fiction because the image of the president leaving the White House in the middle of the night and wandering around the mall in the mist is a powerful image.
With a black writer.
And Eddie Wesley get together, right.
At his side. Picture it. Let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and Elisa. Elisa, you're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Hello, thank you. My comment, and thank you for having this topic. Mm-hmm. My comment today was basically that whereas some African Americans have been able to be successful in spite of our environment, mm-hmm. I think that the ideology, if someone was educated in the public school system in America, remains open to racism. It's an ideology that many Caucasian Americans don't even recognize they have because it's so ingrained in their childhood. And I think because of that, when someone like a Barack Obama comes along who wasn't directly on a regular basis experiencing that, mm-hmm. he's able to give a more unified understanding of all people.
Do you think he's able to represent? Do you think, at least, that he's able to represent those kids who had lived or are living that really disadvantaged experience?
Because he doesn't have that hate or that ingrained seeing people he love, just that hurt.
Yeah, Elisa, we're breaking up a little, but I think we've got it. Stephen Carter, what do you say?
There may be something to that. I do think one thing that to bear in mind about Obama, we talked earlier about the connection between Obama and the civil rights movement, say, of the 60s. Obama is a powerful presence. He's a very thoughtful guy. He draws people to him. He's got a lot of ideas. But also the candidacy in other ways is made possible by the civil rights movement of the 60s. That is, even though the movement mm-hmm. died out or got sidetracked, however you want to describe it, it opened up a lot of important opportunities. And this is part of what you're seeing. I agree with the caller that, of course, there's still a lot of racism to confront and people grow up with a lot of baggage. But there were successes in the movement. There were a lot of opportunities that opened up. There were some channels that came to exist that didn't exist before. And Obama and Barack Obama and Michelle Obama were both the products of those channels and those possibilities that opened up. And I don't think either one of them would deny that. I don't think either one of them would in any way say that they haven't benefited enormously from the sacrifice of the civil rights movement.
You're right.
We all have.
Indeed. You write in an author's note at the end of Palace Council, your latest book, that Nixon's fall from power sort of reflected America, and the end of the Vietnam War reflected a newfound pessimism in the United States. The war was kind of bridged between a period of idealism and sense of opportunity and that pessimism. And then you go into what you call the dawn of modern America, the mean-spirited America of me first, trust nobody, soundbites, revile anyone who disagrees, and devil take the hindmost. All this misbehavior, you write, Stephen Carter, is a mark of our timidity, not our confidence. When Obama talks about change, yes, we can, do you hear him as saying we can change that kind of cultural envelope, attitude, outlook?
I hope that's what he's talking about, because for me, one of the most depressing aspects of politics today is how little of it is about reason and tolerance and conversation, and how much of it is about hating the right people or loving the right people. If you look at the nonfiction bestseller list, so many of the books are about who you should hate. And if you're on the left, you buy one set. If you're on the right, you buy another set. And this is very scary stuff. And I think that what's striking about Obama, and actually McCain as well, there is an aspect of this campaign that is not like the last campaign, that each of them seems to be recognizing that people are simply fed up with campaigns that are really about why you ought to hate the other guy. And each one of them always goes out of his way. Obama always begins, I really respect Senator McCain. Senator McCain begins, I really respect Senator Obama. They do this over and over again. And people say it's just a throwaway line. Maybe it is, but it's a nice throwaway line. If that's going to be the throwaway line, I'd like to hear that throwaway line more often.
They're both, of course, speaking before the NAACP this week, John McCain today. today, talking about African-American children and education, Barack Obama, earlier in the week. Standing ovation for Barack Obama when he presented himself as a symbol of the political power that earlier black leaders have won, as you say. But he also got pretty good support when he repeated his sort of Father's Day message of tough love for African-American kids, of parental responsibility. I mean, he got applause for that. This seems not so long ago that Bill Cosby was getting, jeered.
Well, it's clear that Obama is right. That is to say, we do have a problem in the African-American community, and we need to do more to bring families together and keep them together. But bear in mind, that's not all of his message, because he also says that we also need more economic aid and other things. All that is true. I worry a little bit that sometimes we get too caught up. The area of race is so big, we shouldn't be thinking, is this guy a liberal or a conservative? Is this a left idea or right idea? There are good ideas. My wife likes to say one from column A and one from column B. There are actually good and useful ideas on both the left and the right about how to achieve racial justice. We ought to stop responding to them as, I'm a conservative, I can't like liberal ideas. I'm a liberal, I can't like the conservative ideas. There are all sorts of good ideas out there, and they're desperately needed.
Let's go to Rick in Torrington, Connecticut. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say, standing ovation, nothing political, but a standing ovation to Mr. Carter. I'm halfway through the third book, and I've read the first two, loved them.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say, keep writing, because after my friends and I saw all the nonfiction that you had written in your books, I thought, how can this guy be writing the best quality fiction in America when he's written so much nonfiction?
Rick, tell us, how is the black-white secret cabal going down with you? Are you buying it? Is it persuasive?
I love it. Yeah, I grew up in a conservative, white family, but very, liberal myself. And even within the conservative white family, we always had, black friends. So I know a little bit about the black community, and, from what I know, it's a very realistic, very interesting aspect of it.
Mm. Rick,
More than that, just from a pure lover of fiction, I just wanted to say immediately Stephen Carter went right up to my list, which really only includes, Wally Lamb, another Connecticut resident, and Ruth Rendell, who's probably one of the greatest contemporary British writers of fiction and suspense and psychological mysteries, and you're right up there with them in my book.
Oh, that's great. High praise from the Connecticut corner.
Well, that's high praise, and I'm blushing. I appreciate it. I do want to say one thing about Tom, you mentioned the cabal a moment ago. I want to emphasize again that although writing a thriller, I try to construct these conspiracies. I don't think real life is governed by conspiracies. I don't think it was governed by conspiracies then. There were a lot more secrets then, but I don't think it was one big conspiracy running these behind the scenes. That's a fictional invention, but boy, was it fun to invent and fun to write about.
Eddie Wesley's sister, Junie, in the book Palace Council, imagines that, or dreams, that she might one day be the first woman and the first black president of the United States. I read somewhere, Stephen Carter, you made a bet in your youth, which would come first, and you bet a woman and not necessarily a black woman.
Isn't that interesting? I did. A friend of mine and I, in junior high school, this is back in the 60s, I'm aging myself, back in the 60s, and I was probably in 8th or 9th grade, a friend of mine and I made a bet, which would come first, a black president or a female president, and I was sure it would be a female, he was sure it would be black. We came close on, we almost had a tie this year, so, but I'm just as happy that I mean, losing the bet is fine, winning the bet would have been fine. Too.
Yeah, by nose, maybe. Alden in Newton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Professor Carter. How are you?
Hello.
I'm a big fan of your writing, and I just have a question about your construction of these black families and black power brokers in regards to, say, W.E.B. Du Bois, and how much of the notion of a talented tenth goes into your construction of some of these characters and their interests, and where the line is, or the balancing, the tightrope is between the acquisition of power and the abdication of responsibility for the entire community.
Interesting.
I'll take it off the air. So,
Alden, thanks very much. Stephen Carter.
That's a great question. Du Bois was a great snob, although he had some great ideas. But I think on the second part of your question, that's something that has always fascinated me as a writer of nonfiction as well as fiction, that is the balance between power and responsibility. I would like to believe that everyone who seizes power maintains the ethics and ideals they had in their youth. Sadly, that tends not to be true. It's not that people become evil. It's not that they become corrupt. It's just that winning becomes so important that they start making more and more compromises, and after a while often forget the ideals that first drove them. That's a risk that every politician takes, but so does every corporate CEO and every professor or anyone else who's in a position of influence. That's always the risk. And the most important thing is to stay grounded. And I try to when I write fiction, I try to differentiate between the characters who seem grounded in their families and other people who knew them when, and those who don't.
Mm. Alden, thanks for your call. We've just got half a minute left. You take a few liberties with Harlem here. You're sort of pushing the 30s, 40s, and 50s up into the 60s here in terms of the milieu of Harlem.
Yeah, I do spend some time in a couple of the early chapters talking about some of the old Harlem families and the older women who kind of ran society and decided which parties you could go to. And it's true, most of that was over by the time of the novel. But I figured since I'm writing a thriller, I can take some historical liberties, and it worked pretty well with the fiction.
It sounds like your readers are ready to let you do just that, and we're grateful for it. Stephen Carter's new book is Palace Council. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Carter, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, On Point is produced by a whole lot of great producers who make this show possible every day. Let me tell you some. Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help these days from Sam Gale Rosen, Will Roselip, and Samina Udine. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook, who loves working with all of them and all their great help. This is On Point.